Welcome to Gin and Topic. We have tasted the gin and now we get on to our topic. Hey, Anya.
Hello, Sarah. It's Friday and we're about to learn something and drink some gin.
We are. What could get better than that?
Honestly, I don't know because we've been doing this for 6 series, so clearly we enjoy it.
And hopefully others do too. So, drink and let's learn.
Let's learn. See you in a minute.
Anya, I need gin.
I need a gin.
And I've spent the whole day sharing my knowledge with other people, so I want some new stuff. I'm quite keen for some new stuff.
Just need something to gin. I just need gin. I was trying to come up with something else. I just need gin. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I want my gin.
Okay. Bit of conversation on the side's all right.
It's all right.
Gin's a priority.
Gin's a priority. Yeah. And that's not an insult to our guest. That's just how I'm feeling today. And you notice how I went a little bit Bryn when I said that.
I love that. Get a little bit Bryn. Well, I'm quite up for gin and a little bit of brain.
Stimulation.
Activity. Stimulation with something new. So hopefully we'll get all that. Anyway, do you want to know who we're talking to?
Go on then.
We are talking to Emma Smith.
Emma Smith.
Emma Smith is Journal Development Editor at eLife, which is an independent non-profit committed to improving the way scientific research is reviewed and communicated.
Ooh, interesting. Okay, so we do a lot of sciencey communication stuff on this podcast, realistically.
Well, all our experts will want their science published, their research sort of reviewed, published, communicated with the world. I've never really thought about how that happens.
I have only thought about it in the very vague sense of about, oh God, this is going to age me now, 3-4 years ago at uni. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how long. I did a publishing module. And
ooh, did you know?
I did a small little element.
What did you learn on your publishing module? Do we want to divulge this now or divulge it with the guests?
We can divulge with the guests because there's really not a lot.
Oh, well, in that case, we better keep it. We better keep that tiny we'll little nugget for later. So anyway, that's what we're talking about today. And we, of course, are drinking gin.
Of course.
I can't believe this, Anya. You know, we've been doing this for 6 series now.
That's fucking bonkers, yep.
That's quite a few episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And this all started at home.
Yes. Or
your home. Yes. Still your home, even though you're an adult child.
Thank you.
Near Cambridge. We still haven't had, until today, any gin from the Cambridge distillery.
Did we not have with Hamish?
Well, we had, but not officially, because it was just a little taster from Hamish's own bottle.
Right, so this isn't a commercially available Cambridge distillery gin.
This is, absolutely.
Okay.
Whereas Hamish just shared some of his gin that
and
had
and if you haven't heard that one, go all the way back to series one.
Was it our very first series?
It was our very first. Oh, well, this is quite nice. I feel like I'm coming back home for this little episode. I feel safe and nurtured.
We actually have a bottle. The one we're having today is the Curator's Gin, which is using stuff from the Cambridge University Botanic Garden. I don't know if it's got any honey in it from Hamish's bees. I don't think so. Not in this one. No, doesn't mention any honey and doesn't mention Hamish.
Oh, that's a shame. Shout out to Hamish. If you're still listening, Hamish, we're here. We're thinking of you.
And because we kind of come full circle to this.
We have.
I'm delighted to finally get it on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Series 6, finally coming home to a little Cambridge gin.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Nice. Nice. Aww. So that's what we're doing today.
Lovely.
I haven't told you our topic or our question.
Oh.
I suppose you'd like to know that, wouldn't you? Well, you don't care really, do you? You just want gin.
Well, I mean, I'm still intrigued to know.
Okay, so our topic is sharing science.
Nice.
Because that's what it is in terms of the publishing. And our question is, how do we know what science to trust? And does that process work? Which always, when I'm given that kind of question, I'm thinking, suggests it doesn't, perhaps.
Yeah.
And what can we do to improve it? Which also suggests that maybe it doesn't, because if it works, why would you want to improve it?
Yeah.
So, Anya, we have been curating Series 6 with some awesome guests and good puns.
Can somebody get a tally going for how many of these you managed to do today? Ben, I want a dinger.
And so we've got our gin, we've got our Cambridge Distillery Curators gin. And if you haven't listened to the tasting room, listen. But it's awesome. And if you haven't got some in your glass, get some in the glass. I'm really, really liking it. So the good thing is we get to drink the rest of this glass and maybe another as we talk to our guest. Hello, Emma.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It's I'm going to be a pleasure.
Oh, thank you for joining us.
Gin's involved. Gin's involved. And you've already chosen a good one, so it is going to be a pleasure. So we are going to start, as usual, by letting you kick back and enjoy some of the gin that you've chosen. Pour some more in your glass, lengthen it, do whatever you want with it.
Shot it straight down. Up to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And Anya and I will explore our knowledge on your topic so that you know where we are, what the kind of education level it is.
What age group we are representing knowledge-wise. Are we a five-year-old? Are we a 10-year-old? On a good week, we might be 13.
Oh, steady on, steady. Okay, so... Right, Anya, we are talking sharing science.
Yes.
And our question is, how do we know what science to trust and does that process work?
Yes.
What can we do to improve it?
Yes.
So, is that it? Just all the way through? Yes. So, how do we know what science to trust? The one that sounds right?
We don't, because... people keep saying online about misinformation and how it's all lies, and it's other things that Trump probably said at some point about how you can't trust scientists, you know, that kind of really intelligent bollocks.
That gets harder and harder, doesn't it, in terms of social media and AI and production of all sorts of stuff that's pretending to be real. From my sort of work and the research that I use in my work, there's so much that's been used that's just a myth, you know, bits that pseudoscience that sound right, and people go, oh yes, what was it I heard the other day, first impressions, somebody was like, you know, oh yes, it's a 24/7 that people make like 24 judgments in 7 seconds of meeting you. And I fell down this rabbit hole of trying to find the research that supported that, and guess what, there's nothing. But because it sounded good.
Well, you've hit on something there. If there's research that's into it, you kind of tend to go, yeah, that's legit, I suppose. The minute I see research.
There was nothing.
But there's, yeah.
Well, exactly, because somebody said there was research and said this catchy little something, then everyone goes, oh, yeah. And it kind of connects with my beliefs. So I'll spread it everywhere, but it's absolute bollocks and there is nothing to support it. But then I start to think, okay, hang on, how do we know which research papers are to be trusted? Because you could come out with something and
speaking as somebody who was at uni not ages ago, my whole thing when I was at uni, and bear in mind I did not do an incredibly academic subject, was if it's in a research paper, I'm going to trust it and I'm going to use it for my essay unless it doesn't support my argument, in which case it's bollocks and I'm ignoring it. That's kind of where I stood.
And so how do you know which papers, is it, you know, how those papers come out? Do they only get published? Are there lots of papers that are there that gather dust and nobody gets to see them because they're not rated? Mm-hmm. And maybe they've got some really good research in them, but they don't get out there because...
Yeah. And I said earlier that I had a vague amount of publishing knowledge from my time at uni. Yeah. That was all fiction publishing. It wasn't sciencey publishing. I don't know if there's anything similar between the two of them. I have no idea.
Well, was there anything about who gets published in fiction? Because I wonder whether there's some similarities in terms of who gets published in research. Because you can't publish everything.
Well, I imagine you can. Otherwise, I'd probably be a published author by now. I mean, I wrote Wattpad fan fiction when I was 14. And let me say, a fair few fan fictions have been published these days. I'm just saying.
Well, hang on, though, because you can self-publish. Anyone can publish onto Amazon or anything. So can you self-publish science or, you know, and therefore... Is that...
I feel like we're just adding questions rather than giving any knowledge here.
So I think there seems, from what I know about sort of research going out in terms of research being published, that depending on the publication depends on how weighty your research is. You know, if you got your research into Nature or Science magazine or something, I don't know, other publications are out there, then, you know, obviously that's important. Whereas if it just got published by yourself, then it's mm-hmm. not to be trusted. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the process is or whether that's right. And I'm sure it could be improved.
And I'm sure there's big names in publishing science stuff too, in the same way there is with fiction stuff. And I'm sure if you're a very well-known professor, doctor person, that adds something. All I can think about is Brian Cox right now. I'm trying to think of any other... that's it. I've only got Brian. The universe! Anyway, Emma, any of that, any help at all?
Yeah. So I was jotting down some little notes as we were going.
Love a note taker.
It's because I have a terrible memory. Like, otherwise that entire segment would just go poof. and you hit on a lot of points that I was already planning to hit on in our conversation today. So one of the first things that I wanted to talk about is how do we know what science to trust? And this is through a process called peer review. And so I'll sort of generally just give a bit of an overview mm-hmm. about what peer review is, with the caveat that I work for eLife, which runs a biology and life sciences mm-hmm. journal. So I'm coming at this from biology and life sciences.
Okay.
There are some things, fiction, I'm sorry, I have absolutely zero idea. I'm not going to clue. Okay. I'm sure there's some like sociological and psychological research about fiction that I also am not familiar with. I'm sorry. the way peer review works is it is, as the name suggests, review by mm-hmm. peers. As an author, you and your lab will have done, you know, months and months of research. You've spent hours pipetting chemicals in a laboratory, and now you've done all the statistical analysis. You've written it all up. It's coherent. Your figures are pretty, and like our charts are full of interesting information. Mm-hmm. And now you're ready to share it with the world. And that's where peer review comes in. So you've already done a lot of hard graft mm-hmm. Of just getting the data together, having the idea, processing everything. And then you'll send it to a journal, because journals are the means by which we distribute scientific mm-hmm. knowledge at the moment. Like, as you were pointing out, like, you know, journals like Nature mm-hmm. or Science mm-hmm. Magazine are some of the big names.
They're the only two I could think of. I'm sure there are others.
They're the ones that tend to get picked up a lot in the media because, as you say, like they tend to carry more mm-hmm. weight, and we'll get into the reasons why later. Mm-hmm. But you send it to a journal like Nature or Science or eLife or any of the tens of thousands of journals that are out there. And you'll say, what do you think of my work as an author? And you'll submit your paper to the journal. And the journal will send it out to other scientists who work in your field. So let's say you've got a research paper about the way that spikes work, or the spiky bits of COVID-19 work, right? Let's say that's what your research is about. You'll send that to a journal, and the journal will send it to other people who specialise in virus spikes. And those other scientists, because they know a lot about virus spikes, will be able to provide a lot of very informative and helpful feedback to the authors about about the data they've collected. Does it actually support what you're saying it does? Like, you're saying the COVID-19 spike does this. Does the data you've collected actually say that? And have you collected that data using the latest techniques and collected the data in a way that, you know, is accurate to do? You know, if you're doing particle analysis, you want to be doing it like at CERN in the Large Hadron Collider. You don't want to be doing it,
your kitchen.
In your kitchen, exactly. You know, if someone submits paper and they've done a particle research about their kitchen, in their kitchen, it's like, well, that's probably not the best way to do this.
Yeah. And so the peers are people that are working in the field that therefore know what they're talking about, because like with us thinking about what science can you trust, we trust that our guests are experts in their knowledge, because we don't have the knowledge to then go, that's not true. So these aren't peers that they're working with every day. They're peers that they don't know necessarily, but they're working in their field, so they know what they're talking about and therefore can assess it. Okay.
Yes. And there are very particular rules about, like, if you work like very, very closely with someone, let's say you work so closely together that while you might not have been involved in this particular COVID-19 virus spike paper, you actually share a grant.
So you're probably going to support them because you're like, well, that's my mate. They did a great job. Yeah.
Or if somebody's doing some research that undermines something that you published a little while ago, then maybe you're not going to support them.
Exactly. And so it's a lot of the work that journals do is sort of making sure that those sort of connections, for better or worse, don't undermine like the trust in the process, if that makes sense. Those connections aren't there that are so strong one way or another that if you knew who'd reviewed the paper, you could be like, oh well, that's why the paper got rejected. It wasn't about the science, it was about, you know, a personal vendetta.
So a bit like picking a jury. You know, you're going to be picking the people that aren't going to have a vested interest in the case.
Yes, that's sort of what all journals aim to do, is to make sure that there's no conflicts of interest, even a perceived conflict of interest, because that will then undermine the way other people see the science, right? It doesn't matter if there wasn't the bias there because you worked together. People will look at it and think that there was.
Yeah.
And that's enough to be like, you shouldn't review this paper. And so that's what the journal does. We'll sort of go out, we'll find, you know, virus spike specialists to review this COVID-19 paper. And then
I love that in a little Google search. Virus spike specialist comes a list. Siri, find me.
I don't have a biology like degree. I have a cognitive neuroscience degree. So like it's my familiarity with proteins specifically. Iffy. Mm-hmm. That's not my job. My job's here to sort of tell people about peer review. So just full disclosure, if I'm saying weird science stuff and actual biologists are listening to this and be like, what are you on about? That's why I'm using it as an exemplar, not actual
if
scientific
you are
fact.
Ever biologists listening to this and expecting me to say anything clever, you should probably stop listening. That's not gonna happen.
So you have the authors who've written up their manuscript, they've collected their data, they send it to the journal. The journal finds the peers, who are just other people sufficiently distant from that group of authors to be able to review the work accurately and without bias. And then those scientists will provide feedback about the paper. And then the journal has to make a decision, which is, do we accept the paper, which is, I, the journal, will publish this in my collection of papers, or do we reject the paper? Do we say, actually, no, this one's not for us? And in that case, the authors will get all the feedback from the peer reviewers. and then they'll try a different journal. You know, probably with changes based on what the sort of peer reviewers have said, and then they'll sort of go through that process again. It's really important to note as well that while publication, which is that sort of acceptance, the sort of thumbs up from the journal, saying like other scientists thought this was good, the process of science evaluation doesn't stop there. There is ongoing evaluation even after publication. While sort of publication in a peer-reviewed journal is like gold standard, especially for research that's just coming out, there is sort of that ongoing evaluation as when we learn more and more things, you're sort of looking back on those findings over
and
time.
Going, this is not good. It's a little bit like, or it is good, but
or this is like this is absolutely excellent. Yeah, you think of like how long it takes.
It's like, you know, a book comes out, it's been published, everyone's like, great, great book. It's Sunday Times bestseller, and then a few years later you go on Goodreads and it's gone way down. They've gone, actually, now I'm reading this, and you can really read the racism that we didn't realise the author had.
Oh, you see, you went down books. I went down red wine. And the fact that you get, it's good for you, it's bad for you. It's good for you, it's bad for you. It's not quite as good as it was for you, but it's worse for you. And yeah, all of those are getting published all the time.
There's like a lot of discussion about topics, in particular healthcare. Like healthcare is a big one that gets brought up a lot because it's important to everyone, right? A lot of people are very, very worried about their health.
We've been told we probably shouldn't drink as much gin as we do, but we're still going.
Apparently gin is a processed food, but I'm ignoring that. I think it's important for
health's
well-being.
Important to everybody else.
but back to peer review.
Yes.
And which ones get in and which ones get and of course, you know, we're talking about being published in these magazines, and it's not the same as going with a good story or a good article. You know, this is research that people are doing that doesn't get out to the public domain unless it gets published. It's not just like,
yes,
you know, oh, you're a good story. It's stuff that we should know about and should get out there. So then this decision is to, oh no, we had one of those last week. You know, we can't have that. It's a bit weird.
It is. This sort of brings us kind of onto like, does the process work? And I think that problem that you point to of like the research that isn't being published is
the non-sexy research.
Sometimes it's non-sexy. Sometimes it's like the methods just don't quite add up. Other times it is things like the null results go into that like unsexy category, which is basically we didn't find anything. But the way that you work out you haven't found anything is that doesn't mean there isn't anything there. It just means we didn't find it. So does that mean actually there's genuinely nothing here? Or does it mean we just did the experiment wrong or just didn't have enough people participating?
Can I go back a step a little just to understand? So in terms of science publishing, as we said, it's not about sort of publishing fiction and nice story, does it get in the magazine? How important is the publishing for researchers in their own field? Is publishing just to get out into the public domain, or is it that you've got to publish your research so that other researchers can be working with it?
So historically, and this is changing somewhat with the advent of the internet and things, but historically, publishing is kind of not the only way you can go to conferences and things, but it's the primary way that scientific communication happens. It's by publishing your work with a journal, a peer-reviewed journal. And that kind of thing helps. It's important both for scientific research, because that was the primary way of sharing information, and also personally, like, you need publications to progress in your career. As an academic, so all of the amazing people that you've had on this podcast so far, all of them will be actively publishing papers, because that's like the primary metric for their career progression. And the other metrics for their career progression typically derive from your publications, what you published, mm-hmm. where you published. And so that sort of leads to a lot of more systemic issues that, given how important it is to publish within science, basically everything kind of for the longest period of time, getting your work out there hinged on getting an accepted decision from a journal. That was your research funding for you to be able to continue doing your experiments. It was, getting a promotion or going to a different, from postdoc to a lecturer, as well as just generally, progressing, scientific knowledge and sort of sharing information like that. There were quite a few issues with the sharing of that science. So the first is paywalled research. So I don't know how many times you or your listeners have ever tried to look at like an academic paper. But a lot of the time, you'll see the title, you'll see the names of the authors, and then you'll see a box saying, if you want to read more, pay $30. And so that's paywalling research. And it's important to note that that's, journals do need some form of funding because, in addition to finding reviewers and making sure that those reviewers don't have conflicts of interest and things like that, journals also do things like keep a permanent record of the research that they do accept, making sure that's hosted online in a permanent way with like a unique identifier. Some journals still have like print editions, so you've still got like ink and paper costs to worry about. Typesetting is needed to make sure that it makes sense in the print journal and also online, and online on a desktop versus your mobile versus an iPad. Then having additional initiatives and staff members to sort of help engage the community and sort of reach a wider and more diverse sort of audience and set of contributors and peer reviewers. And so there are a lot of things that journals do that are important work to do. But the solution to that for like most of the 20th century was, well, we're going to block access to the research and you'll pay for it.
Yeah.
Which was the subscription model, because libraries would subscribe to the journals in as one, I guess, used to subscribe to magazines. I think
people still do, like newspapers do. There are certain newspapers that, again, the same. You go on to look at an article, normally that's been sent by my mum, and I go to have a look at it, and it then goes, subscribe. And I'm like, no, not that bothered. No. So I text back going, I'm sure it was very interesting. So I think there is that subscription to... And then that barrier to actually accessing.
Yeah. And so the way in which that has sort of systemically been addressed is through something called the open access movement, which started around early noughties, late 90s, early noughties. Again, for primarily biology. Led to like the creation of a set of journals known as the Public Library of Science, or PLOS. In that, it was a sort of...
It's great. PLOS.
My very northern accent is really PLOS.
But then you get the other end of the spectrum where we're there going, PLOS. It just, PLOS. It's not as good,
No.
but yes, you have like the PLOS set of journals, which sort of helped to sort of pioneer this sort of open access way of publishing, which is instead of you... at the library, or you as the individual, if you don't have access through a university library, paying for each individual article or each individual issue. The authors use their grant funding to just pay one off, and then everyone can read it. And that sort of really helped with scientific communication, because you can, think of a world where, there are tens of thousands, if not, hundreds of thousands of journals out there. Your library can't support an infinite number of journals. It's only got a limited amount of funding. And so they support, the big names in your field of, we'll go back to virus spikes. They follow these particular sets of sort of virus protein journals. And then you are searching for additional research to sort of... get the lay of the land within a particular sort of theory about virus spikes, and you see a perfect paper, but it's in a journal mm-hmm. that your library doesn't mm-hmm. subscribe to. And then you, the researcher, have to make a decision of, well, do I spend my grant funding mm-hmm. getting access to a mm-hmm. paper that I don't even know if it's going to be what I need or want it to be? And then if I choose not to, I could just be duplicating yeah. research. I could just be like trying to rediscover something they already found out. I just don't know they found it out because I can't read mm-hmm. the paper. And so you sort of had this sort of open access movement to sort of really sort of address that and speed up the way that science was communicated, because everyone could just read it. And it's getting to the point now, like this movement has gone on so long and pushed so far that basically every single journal has the option to publish open mm-hmm. access. You know, especially a lot of the really, really big name journals, you can choose how you want to publish. So you know, getting that sort of movement from those big journals that were primarily subscription based before was sort of really a sort of indicator that the publishing process and the publishing system was moving mm. to accommodate this, you know, ground support for open access. And now we have like giant organizations and funders requiring open access mm. publishing. It's like, if you get money from us, you have to publish open access. And this includes organizations across the EU and funding agencies. I mean, last year, 2023, was the year of open science in America. So that means organizations like NASA and the National Institute of Health were doing a lot of work to make sure that their researchers were publishing mm-hmm. in a way that was sort of open access mm-hmm. that everyone could read.
So it seems bonkers that from an outside perspective, we think of researchers being in this field of research, that mm. they have access to everything that's ever been researched mm. in their field. But actually, that's not true. That's yeah. quite a new thing that's being initiated to enable that open access. But it seems bonkers that they shouldn't be able to access that research that's been done in the yeah. field. Because yep. if you come with an idea, hey, I'm going to research this, mm. and everyone goes, oh, yeah, it's a really good idea. Yeah, I'll go get funding for it. I'll go and do all of that. And then you find that actually it was researched ages ago and found to be rubbish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But unless that's available, we have no idea.
Yeah, you just wouldn't know. And so it's sort of really important that people just have access to the science in the first place. And as you pointed out, another barrier to the access is whether or not the journals accept mm. the paper or not. You know, they might choose to reject it, in which case it's sort of, you have to go through the entire process again at another mm. journal. Mm. And that other journal won't have access to the reviews that your mm-hmm. COVID-19 virus spike paper got from journal one. So they'll be getting an entirely new set of virus spike specialists mm-hmm. to look mm-hmm. at the work. And then you'll get an entirely new set of comments. And now you might have to do an entirely new set of experiments, because Journal 1 and Journal 2 had completely different mm. reviewers. And so the point that I want to sort of make with this is sort of twofold. That process is very slow.
Yeah.
So typically, when you're sort of looking at like how long it takes a paper from when the authors think it's ready, which is when they first submit to a journal.
I've done my research, I've written it up.
I've done my research, written it up. It's ready to share. This is why I'm sending it to a journal. It's ready to share. Through to when a journal actually gives the thumbs up and says, yes, we agree it's ready to share, is around 8 months.
Wow.
Which is the same amount of time it takes to, you know, send the Mars rover to Mars or to gestate most of a human being. Yeah. Right? That's
I was gonna say, like, you could have a small baby in that time. Like, granted, yeah. they might need a little extra support, but they'd be alive.
Yeah.
And if somebody is submitting a paper to a journal, can they submit to mm-hmm. more than one journal at once and kind of start a little bidding war for who gets to publish this? Or do they just have to do one at a time?
Just one at a time.
Oh, that's so rude.
So
oh
you have
God.
To send it and then 8 months yeah. be told whether they accept it or not. And then
it can
the
be.
Process again.
So the 8 months thing isn't necessarily all at the same journal, mm. Although it can be. There are a lot of stories out there. I mean, you wouldn't have to talk to researchers long before you start hearing stories of, well, it took me, you know, a year, 2 years to get this paper out there.
Wow.
So it's a very, very difficult place for authors to be, for it to be that slow. And then in addition to that, it's incredibly wasteful of academics' time. I think the average time to review, don't quote me on this, but it's a few hours. And so you'll have usually between 3 and 5 reviewers on a paper at one journal. And then they're going to some more people and asking some more people to spend 3 or 4 hours on it. And there was an analysis done of the amount of time academics spent on peer review in 2020. And in 2020 alone, 15,000 years of academic time was spent on peer review. 15,000 years.
Wow.
We still had glaciers across the Northern Hemisphere 15,000 years ago, right? Neanderthals were still extant. They were still here.
Oh my gosh.
So it's all of that time that could have been used, you know,
researching, you know, doing stuff.
Yeah. And the feedback that the reviewers had at Journal One isn't wrong or bad. It's still useful. And it's useful for the second journal to know and for the second journal to know what, you know, the authors have done in response. It's just that communication doesn't really happen behind the scenes. I mean, it can, but it is a like very manual process and relies on authors sharing information to Journal 2 and for Journal 2 to then go to Journal 1 and say, hey, the authors said this and that you reviewed their paper and can you share the reviews with us and are you willing to share their identities with us? And a lot of journals won't have policies against sharing that information as sort of breach of confidentiality kind of agreements and kind of things like that. Not like NDA kinds of agreements, but just that there's a general understanding that things are anonymous unless you know, consented to otherwise within the publishing world. And again, you're still dependent on that sort of accept reject decision, which from the author's standpoint means, okay, you've got a bunch of feedback from the peer reviewers. This feedback's really great and really useful, but they're asking me to do something extra that's going to lead down an entirely new path. That's another 3 years of like a sustained piece of grant funding, right? That's an entire other project. It's interesting and, you know, should be investigated, but not here and not now.
So, but the review isn't going, yes, this paper makes sense, publish it. It's then going, yes, this paper is okay, but actually I think they should be doing some other work and therefore they should spend more time doing some other work that I just think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So most of the reviews that you get are along the lines of the authors are claiming X. The data supports the claims of X up to a point. They could strengthen their claims of X by doing these experiments.
Okay.
And then it would be interesting if they could build on X to find out why. So that's like most of, you know, the comments that you kind of get, that sort of general structure and framework of a review. When you have a situation like we have in the publishing world, where your career and your research and being able to progress in your research and get funding to do additional stuff is dependent on getting that accept. You as the author then have to make the call about what experiments you can do, what experiments you can't do and why. And so there'll be a back and forth.
And so I'm thinking, Anya, that this is a bit like you when you were at uni doing your master's and writing.
Yeah, go on, Sarah. Demonstrate
script.
How much you know about my degree well, and my master's. Go on. Yeah.
You telling me over a gin about how frustrating you would write some form of script. And then you submit it to your lecturers and then you'd get comments back about, you know, bits that they'd suggest that you should change, bits that you'd work on. And of course, you'd read them out to me going, oh, for fuck's sake.
Sean, if you're listening, I never did it to you. Sean, I never did it to you. Listen, some comments are very valid. Some were not.
But, well, because many of those must be from a personal perspective of these are the things
Well, it's funny you talk about that because we had a module, and again, it's very different, where we would sit as a class and we would workshop each other's writing, and you would have the people in class who would workshop your writing and you'd go, great, I'm going to take all their notes and I'm going to implement them and they're great. And then you'd have the people who, when they were talking about what they would do if they had your work, you would zone them out because you know that their writing has absolutely no relevance to what you're writing.
And that must also happen within that peer review, that you're being reviewed by people who are researching in that similar field, who obviously have an area of interest that would be then saying that actually you need to do more on that mm-hmm. to support mm-hmm. it. But that might not be where you want your research to go.
Exactly. Like that's a prime example of... sort of one of the issues that we have in the current publishing system, and then this is where I pivot to potential solution, because we have one, and it's good. Yay. And I want to sort of share that information with you, because you know, there's ways of changing this, so I don't want to be all doom and gloom. Like there are ways of sort of changing things. So within biology, there has been sort of a new emergence of these things called preprints. Now, I specify in biology because mm-hmm. preprints have been around for decades in physics. Maths and physics primarily operate using preprints now, and the journal publication is more of a formality.
So they're ahead of the game, are they? They're the ones that have been leading the way, and everyone's been going, yeah, they've got a point.
Yeah, so that's sort of... you know, one of the things that we sort of really want to embrace within sort of biology and life sciences mm. is sort of this move towards preprints. So what are preprints? They are, you know, I said that there's that moment where you, the author, have done all your experiments, you've done all your stats, it's ready to share. Mm. And then you have the waiting game with the journals. Mm. Instead, now you can be like, I'll do the waiting game with the journals because I do still need journal publication, and the reviewer feedback is still important. They are still giving me, you know, insightful comments that can help me improve my work, but I want to share this now because I think it's ready to share, and maybe I can get some more insightful feedback, you know, because it's available to a broader set of people rather than just the people that the journal can find as available to review the work. And so you post your preprint to a preprint server, and it's just an unreviewed version of the manuscript. You've just typed it up in Word doc.
So it's like self-publishing on Amazon. It's just mm-hmm. putting it out there mm-hmm. in its rough and ready form and going, yeah, read it.
Bingo. And so that goes back to your sort of self-publishing science mm-hmm. thing of, yes, that's doable now. And so there are a lot of different preprint servers out there. Like the kind of OG, to the best of my understanding, is the physics one, which was set up in 1991, called Archive. And since then, more of these have sprung up. And so you have BioArchive and MedArchive, which publish biology and medicine papers, preprints, sorry. And as well as like ChemArchive for chemistry.
And I only know Archive of Our Own for fan fiction.
So. cannot recommend going on Archive of Our Own for, you know, scientific research.
Definitely
Not one of the archives.
No. I don't think I've ever seen anything even vaguely scientific on there.
Sorry, the AO3 comment has just got me.
This is what I bring to the podcast. I just bring ridiculous stuff that breaks people.
And so the benefits of preprints. So mm-hmm. yeah, so there's BioArchive, MedArchive. You also have area-based preprint servers like mm-hmm. Africa Archive for mm-hmm. researchers based in Africa. And preprints are great because they are open. Anyone can read them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're immediate. You can read them pretty much straight away. They've sometimes got a brief bit of quality checking from the preprint server to make sure that like absolute like nonsense isn't being published and to make sure, you know, things like ethical standards are, you know, broadly being upheld. They are controlled by authors, so authors aren't waiting around for the journals to sort of give that yay or nay accept reject decision, which is really, really great. But other scientists haven't had a say on those papers yet. So authors can publish things and, you know, through no fault of their own, they can, you know, be incorrect, or maybe the methodology they've used isn't the best. And unless you're an expert in that field, you won't know. And I think what we saw in this sort of, there was a huge proliferation of preprints during COVID-19 and the pandemic, because funnily enough, a lot of people were doing research on that because it was really important. And it really, really helped speed up research, because people who worked on COVID-19 and virus spikes, among other like health health and epidemiology research, they could assess the work themselves and incorporate it straight away into their work. Then it becomes a huge issue for the general public and for journalists who aren't necessarily, you know, trained in science and scientific research. And even if you were trained, you're probably not keeping up to date with it, because, you know, who casually spends their spare time reading the latest research in spike research, COVID virus spike research? You know, like, that's not...
Only others that are really working on it in that time and don't drink gin.
I'm sure quite a few people of them were drinking gin during the pandemic, not gonna lie.
And reading the papers.
Who wasn't?
So then that brings us to the issue of, okay, so we've fixed that it's slow, but it's not... you don't necessarily know straight away that you can trust it. And so basically a lot of people and a lot of organizations are pivoting to reviewing preprints specifically and making the reviews available on those preprints so that people have like a rule of thumb to then judge that work. And so it's faster than the traditional model, because you're not waiting 8 months to hear what other scientists have to say about it.
So unlike the last one where the paper goes to the reviewers and they review it and then it potentially gets published, these are now papers that get published and then they get reviewed. And so you can either look at the papers pre-review or you get them with the reviews afterwards.
Exactly. It's funny that you use those words of it gets published, then reviewed, or reviewed, then like reviewed, then published. So the traditional model is reviewed, then curated with the accept reject decision, and then published.
Oh, look, it's our gym.
Oh, we're back.
And this new model, which is sort of this is a broad umbrella term for a lot of different like sub-models within there, but it's publish, as you say, you publish that preprint, you put the science out there straight away, then it gets reviewed, and then it gets curated based on those reviews. eLife last year launched what we've called our new model, which is a version of this publish, review, curate. And so what we only review preprints, so every submission that comes to us, the authors have already made available out there in the world as a preprint, people can already read it. And then our editors, who are all working scientists in the field, so they've got all that up-to-date knowledge that they need, can then decide to send the manuscript for review or not. And if it gets reviewed, then all of the reviews are made publicly available on the preprint, and it's accompanied by an eLife assessment, which is a short little paragraph right underneath the abstract, which describes in sort of using terminology that we've come up with. It describes how significant the work is to the field and how you know, strong the methodology supporting those claims is. And so what you end up with, which we think's funky and cool, is a paragraph where the authors describe their work and what their claims are, and then right underneath, the scientists and peer reviewers giving a summary of what they thought of the manuscript, and then the authors can choose how they want to respond. So it's giving, keeping the that author control, which, you know, was lacking in the traditional model, brings them in, and then they can choose how they want to revise it, and if they want to revise it, because, you know, as we've touched on, like some of the reviewer comments are great, but lead onto like another 5-year project. And it's like, that's not for right now.
Yeah.
And then the author response also made public. So the authors, you have that very, very open dialogue published on each version of the manuscript. So you can sort of go through and you can see the history of the manuscript and you can see how it's changed and why it's changed. And it sort of gives that sort of transparency to the process. Whereas before, what what you got was, I know it's been reviewed, which itself is, you know, a good marker.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not, it's sort of opening up a black box of what review is,
yeah,
and sort of giving you more of an idea of what reviews look like and how authors respond to them. And so, yeah, we think that's sort of a direction for publishing to go, to really sort of help address that sort of dual problem of being slow, reviews and reviewers' time and academics' time getting wasted, and then sort of that difficulty with preprints specifically, you know, not, if you don't have the expertise to assess it, you're sort of, you know, stuck waiting around until a journal says something. It sort of addresses that issue as well. But yeah, there are lots and lots of people and organisations out there that are doing, you know, reviews of preprints. F1000 Research makes all the reviews available, makes the preprint available, and then they give sort of an approved, not approved, approved with reservations kind of deal. Peer Community In provides reviews, and they have different communities like evolutionary biology and ecology and things like that, amongst many, many, many other organisations.
So going back then to us as as public sort of receivers of research, and again, as you've been bringing up with the COVID spikes and all the rest of it, and you know, you're presented with research as trusted stuff, and we'd hope it is. How do we know? And going, you know, also thinking about the pseudo research that gets published on social media and all the rest of it, how would we know what science to trust?
So going by journal name has historically been what science you can trust. There are tens of thousands of sort of journals out there. If it says it's been peer-reviewed, sort of historically, that's meant that it can be trusted. As we shift to a new world where all of the science is available, the reviews are available, and things like that, it's going to require some additional form of indicator, like we have with the eLife assessment, and like F1000 has with the sort of approved, not approved, approved with reservations kind of thing, where there is some kind of sort of summary that's sort of accessible to non-scientists to sort of know how and when to trust that, and to make it sort of short, concise, you know, Twitterable, I mean, X-able.
Oh, it's just Twitter, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and we forget all of those. But I mean, I'm trying to sort of scrabble and connect this with sort of everyday stuff that it's kind of like. And I'm thinking about shopping and, you know, the whole you Google search things and those trusted reviews and, you know, knowing which ones are real and which ones have been fabricated, and being able to have those kinds of stamps of those trusted places that you know that the reviews are actually correct, and you know, you can be certain that actually straight away I can see this has been peer reviewed and it's a trusted stuff that I can take away. Okay, so going back to our question, let's make sure that we've got everything. So how do we know what science to trust? We're talking about where it's been published and whether it's been peer-reviewed. Are there any other ways of improving this process that we haven't covered?
So I think something that you sort of alluded to very early on was around who gets published, which is kind of a reference to sort of biases within the peer review process. And as much as we do our best to avoid them, we live in a society, and that society has a lot of systemic issues. And it, you know, it is important to note that that does affect the way peer review works. And so, you know, people who are more likely to be underrepresented in science or marginalized communities are less likely to get reviewed. And then when they are reviewed, they're less likely to get published. Then when they do get published, they're less likely to get cited. And because they're less likely to get cited, they're less likely to get awards. And then because they're less cited, less awarded, and with fewer publications, they're less likely to get promoted and less likely to get funding. And it sort of becomes this sort of vicious compounding cycle, which is sort of also a priority for the academic publishing world to address. And so there are a lot of initiatives being done to sort of help sort of break this cycle, which include things like ensuring that your reviewer pool is diverse, because a lot of like review can sometimes be like network based, and so it ends up being a bit old boys clubby. And so it's about making sure that, you know, women and gender diverse and researchers of colour and you know, disabled researchers.
All the people who aren't down the bloody dinner club with their fucking coats and tails.
So getting them as involved in the process as possible, as reviewers and as editors, creating policies so that research that is done in areas like the Global South isn't only done by, you know, white Western Global North authors, making sure that, you know, the scientists who are probably doing the work on the ground are actually incorporated into authorship and things. So that's anti-parachuting, if anyone wants to look that up.
And does that also mean that you can comment on peer review as well? So that, you know, because there must be those systemic sort of issues within those reviews just because of the type of people that are working with those fields, that you can't always have diverse everywhere on everything, because it's not always attractive to everyone to be working in that field. So then is there the ability to then, you know, if you've got reviews on papers, to then have other people commenting or reviewing the reviewers, as it were, sort of continuing through?
I think that is a great next step for where we are at the moment. Right now, we are still in a stage where most journals don't share their reviews at all. So it's very hard to comment on the reviews when you don't have access to the reviews. I think that, you know, it will be beneficial long term to have reviewers be transparent and for just everything to be out in the open. Like, sunlight's the best disinfectant. So, like, let's just open things up. But we need to make sure that we're doing that in a responsible way, and not like opening up underrepresented and younger researchers to, you know, unnecessary criticism and like, you know, criticism that isn't constructive. So that's sort of one sort of angle of it, is sort of improving representation in the reviewer and sort of editor pool. And also that early career engagement, making sure that you're sort of thinking of sort of early career researchers, because they're going to be the next generation of academics, right? They're going to be the next set of scientists. And sort of improving the way that we do scientific communication just with the general public. Because right now, like, academia is, you know, pretty rightfully seen as kind of a bit of an ivory tower.
Well, and from that public sort of consuming of that research, and once it's been distilled into whatever publication, there is often, because we don't understand it, we can think it's incredibly simple, but what you've explained is how incredibly complex it is and how difficult it is to manage that balance. And to ensure all of that sort of security and respectability of that research, and that you're balancing all of the parties, from those that are producing it and getting it out there and getting all their funding, and those that are reviewing it and those that are depending on it and all the rest of it. It's a lot to be juggling. And thank you so much for explaining, you know, some of it to us, to be able to understand a process that we've never really had to pay any attention to, apart from, you know, does that sound like it's true or not, and does it have kind of some decent credentials? You know, that's kind of all that we're looking at. So really understanding how that comes to pass is a really useful conversation that we've had. So thank you.
Yeah, well, I just hope it was useful for you and for your listeners to sort of understand, like, where these papers that are talked about and studies that are talked about in the newspapers kind of come from.
Oh, thank you. And
thank you for the
Tops gin.
Always.
Cheers. Yes.
Mine's empty.
Tops gin. So Thank you for the gin.
Thank you.
It's been really good. It's been peer reviewed. I said it's good.
Oh, well done, Sarah. Very clever. I wish I'd thought of that one. Have you drunk too much gin, or do you remember anything?
Well, I have drunk too much gin because it is really, really nice. So it's good, I poured myself a little bit of extra cheekiness. But have I remembered anything? Yes, I have. And I have learned a lot because, you know, I will quite often go online and look at research papers and mm-hmm. I search, you know, Google Scholarly or whatever and various other things, and you find all this stuff.
Yeah, you love a little paper. You love a little paper.
Love a paper. But I've never really thought about the process that goes from the people that do the research, that do the science, that write up all of the stuff that they've been doing, and then it being there for someone to read.
Yeah, you just kind of access it and read it.
Yeah, and do you know what I find? I find a bit weird is that you've got these people doing the research and then they produce their stuff, but then it kind of goes into this process of sort of bidding to be good enough to be in a magazine, which I just think, hang on a second, that's just a bit odd. It isn't something that's necessarily sexy and shiny that needs to be out in the public. It's just good research that other people doing research need to know about. And that sort of chasm between the stuff that goes into a magazine that you or I might pick up, like Nature, maybe not, or Science magazine, maybe not. Not quite the magazine of your choice, hey Anya.
I'm just thinking that clearly you haven't had enough gin at all, because look at you go. You're like, I've got more things that I'm thinking about, actually.
But I just keep thinking about, you know, that whole, actually, it's just research that other people need to know. Yeah. And so the more that we can do to make that easier and more accessible, the better.
The better.
So I love this whole preprint idea.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the more that they can do to just get them to print their stuff, publish their stuff, have it reviewed. I love the whole little system that these places are coming up with to sort of say whether it's, you know, good, mediocre research, you know, whether it's been well substantiated.
Just a smiley face rating. That would work.
It would work, wouldn't it? It would really work.
We'll recommend that next time.
Yeah, and a really difficult juggling act as to who's reviewing and keeping that balance of as many voices, being able to give those reviews that also know that they're talking about. It's a hard old world, and I'm just glad I'm not working in it.
I don't think there's anything left for me to say, really. No, I think that's pretty much done, covered it. Well done.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Well done them.
Well done them. Keep up the good work, gang.
And can I also say that every time I kept thinking about poor researchers going out there and going, would you publish, would you publish? And I'm thinking about, you know, how similar it is with actors going to, you know,
would you
going
please
out and
hire
going,
me?
Hire me. And you with writing and all sorts, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, don't let the fuckers get you down.
Oh, what a good way to end it, Sarah. What a hopeful message you're leaving us with. Gorgeous.
Because there's always gin.
There's always gin.
But anyway, so there we go. Next week, another gin, another topic.
Whoop, whoop.
See you then.
See you then. I'm mind-boggled and I've got an empty glass, and that is gin and topic in a nutshell.
Oh, it is. So it was good, and we will fill that glass for next week. And we will empty our brains, sieve-like, and be ready to learn more next week.
Sarah, before next week, where can everyone find us?
Well, they can find us on social media at Topic Gin, or they can head over to our website, ginandtopic.com, and they can message us, they can, you know, interact with us on that social media type platformy thing. And of course, don't have to wait a whole week.
No.
Because we've got Tuesday Booze Day on Tuesday, introducing the gin. And they can always listen to episodes that they might not have listened to whilst they're waiting.
We've got 6 whole series. You've got 5 to go back and listen to if you haven't already. And we will see you on Tuesday for Tuesday Booze Day.
Nice. Cheers.
Sláinte.